This episode of Between the Rows was brought to you in part by Bayer. Bayer continues to make significant investments into the development of new breeding technologies and state-of-the-art cropping solutions to ensure the profitability and sustainability of your farm. This season, grow with confidence. Grow with Bayer. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we hear from Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, who fills us in on what he heard, saw, and tasted at the World Pork Expo.
Not one, but two press conferences on foot and mouth disease. So it seems like right now there's a big concern in the industry about this disease coming in to North America from places like India or other parts of the world.
John Gregg of Glacier Farm Media discusses progress on Canada's national food policy talks.
And certainly there seems to be more interest in government in agriculture than people I've talked to have ever seen.
And Glacier Farm Media's Bruce Burnett reveals some excitement in spring wheat markets.
Well, there's a combination of factors here that is making the spring wheat market very interesting right at the present moment and probably remain interesting through most of the marketing year here.
All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Ed White.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Canada doesn't have a national food policy. That might soon change. John Gregg, Glacier Farm Media Ontario field editor, joins us to talk about that right now. Hi, John, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed.
So what is the national food policy?
So that's actually one of the really critical questions in all of this. And the national food policy is something that food and farming organizations have been calling for, some of them for up to a decade. But what's changed is that the Liberal government in the last election actually campaigned on a national food policy priority and made it a priority for the Agriculture Minister, Lawrence McAuley. The food policy, and this is part of the challenge, is defining it, is will set overarching goals across the government and then by extension through the industry and you know, farms and processing and retailers for food and agriculture. And we haven't had those overarching goals. And then the other thought is that it will probably create some sort of governance structure to help study and administer and achieve those goals.
So who's behind this thing? Who's driving it?
So the federal government is very interested, and from what people have told me, very interested right up to the Prime Minister's office in the food policy. So they are certainly a driver. The Canadian Federation of Agriculture has been asking for a food policy for quite a while, with the assumption or the thought that having overarching goals which stretch through government would help make things more efficient and as well drive even longer term planning than what we're used to in the 5-year cycle for the agriculture policy framework in agriculture. And then other food groups, such as Food Secure Canada, which is an umbrella group for organizations that work on food issues across the country, has been calling for a national food policy for a decade. So there's a lot of different groups and organizations that have come together at this point and said, hey, this is the time to do it.
And you mentioned the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. What kind of a role are farmers playing here?
The Canadian Federation of Agriculture, along with other groups, is really having to figure out how to talk to organizations that they might not have had as many direct conversations with in the past. So earlier this month, the Federation of Agriculture hosted a meeting in Ottawa, but it was different than most you'd expect a farmer organization to host. They had very diverse people throughout the food chain there. They had people who studied nutrition at the University of Toronto. They had Health Canada, Environment and Climate Change Canada, Indigenous Northern Affairs Canada, and then various other organizations and groups such as Food Secure Canada there as well. And they're really keen, all these groups, to get out ahead of the government as opposed to having something imposed or the government say, okay, this isn't going to work, because the government has really set a very fast timeline for this to develop.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds really ambitious and quite complicated, and ambitions often fail or have a way of just sort of frittering away. How hopeful are the participants that this will actually lead to something that really works out?
So I guess I'd separate hope and optimism. There is a lot of optimism around this. The groups that are involved see this as the opportunity that they've, the best opportunity they've ever had to develop something like this. And I think they realize that the chance of another chance is slim. So I think there is some optimism and some interest in groups that in the past have, because of their ideological motivations, their profit motivations, their funding motivations, have been had very defined and sometimes intractable positions. They're realizing that they really need to talk to and work with some organizations that they may not have had talked to all that much before. They need to work together to set definitions and how to go about creating this very large policy project. The federal government, for example, when it set the National Policy Framework Consultation, said that it was involving 16 different government ministries and agencies, which is really extraordinary in government, if you know anything about how government runs, for them to do that. And as you said at the start, the concern is, can they actually get there by next spring, which is what the agriculture minister has said. He wants it mostly sorted out by next spring.
This process is going to add a lot of players to agriculture and food policy decisions and discussions that aren't normally there. It's normally mostly been farmers. What do farmers need to understand about what this is adding to the policy development talk?
So I asked a question like that to Ron Bonnet, who's the president of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, and he says that some of it is the fact that farmers have done so much better job of reaching out to consumers over the last 5 or 7 years. That's really become a bit of a cause célèbre within the industry. And he says that it's paying off in that other organizations are more interested and more willing to have open discussions with farmers. And then as well, Bonnet said that one of the biggest things that the Canadian Federation of Agriculture wants to get out of this is that longer-term planning look. More than just the five-year ag policy framework churn, right? Every 5 years we get in, you're a few years through it, and then the negotiations start again. The ag policy framework, of course, it sets agriculture policy through the federal and provincial governments all the way through, and they are looking that there can be more efficiencies and more for farmers if that policy is planned out over many more years. And then the third thing that I think is important for farmers is the CFA really hopes that there can be more efficiency within government as long as the national food policy drives more coordination among all those ministries. The government ministries often work in silos, and that's been something that's bugged the Federation of Agriculture for a long, long time. And Ron Bonnet says he thinks the word's come down from the top that some of that needs to end, and that he has seen some changes that way. He's seen ministries like Health Canada and the CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, at meetings and more openly engaged with farmers than they have been before. So I think it's that opening up of ag policy to a bigger world, which hopefully will make it more efficient and more integral to the whole of the government, which is part of the potential benefit for farmers.
This seems like a lot of focus on agriculture and food. Is this part of any bigger framework or any bigger drive within the government?
And certainly there seems to be more interest in government in agriculture than people I've talked to have ever seen. And the belief is the overall driver will be a national food policy, but there's several other things going on which are important to farmers and farming and food. There's the renewal of Canada's food guide at the Ministry of Health. There's the national sustainability strategy, which I understand in the first draft did mention food and agriculture, but in the second draft put a priority on sustainable food systems. Then there's the ag policy framework. The next one is due to be finalized by the end of the year. And then there's the whole, what was called the Barton Report, the Advisory Council on Economic Growth, which runs through the Treasury Board and Ministry of Finance, that identified agriculture as one of the potential major drivers for middle-income income growth. So that's important, too. And then there's also innovation strategy through the Ministry of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development, that they're developing innovation superclusters, and there's a lot of interest in agriculture in that area as well. So it's a very complicated time in the agriculture policy world, but some people think it is an unprecedented opportunity for the industry.
We'll certainly keep watching this. Thanks for joining us today, John.
Thanks, Ed. It was my pleasure.
John Gregg is Ontario Field Editor for Glacier Farm Media. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Ed White. Every June, thousands of farmers and hog industry players descend on Des Moines, Iowa for the World Pork Expo. The Western Producers, Robert Arneson, was there to cover it, and he joins us now. Hi, Robert, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed.
Before we get into the really serious details about what you saw down there, what did you see, touch, smell, and feel about pigs and pork?
Well, you know, one of the highlights of the show is that you actually get to, you know, get up close and see pigs. They have several, you know, massive swine barns there as part of sort of a national junior swine show. And you see a lot of teenage kids and, you know, 7-8-year-old kids walking around with pigs. And then they have, you know, show rings where the competitors bring their pigs in. And then, of course, it's judges. And they have these grandstands set up where there's like hundreds of parents and other people and grandparents watching the pigs and the kids walk around. So it's quite an impressive sight. And, you know, just again, just to be that up close to pigs is kind of unusual because, you know, even as a agricultural reporter up here in Canada, we just don't see pigs very often. So, and as well, you know, it just, you see some unique things that you don't see elsewhere, such as they have these massive grills and, you know, huge racks of pork ribs on there, sort of thing that, and then there's lineups of like hundreds of people waiting to get their free sample of pork ribs or a pulled pork sandwich. And then, of course, the bacon-flavored ice cream is always popular as well. So.
Well, that sounds maybe delicious. I'm not sure. Okay, let's get into the more serious stuff now. So what was the mood down in Des Moines this year at the World Pork Expo?
Well, I guess overall it's a huge global show and, you know, attracts, I think this year, about 20,000 people. So, you know, there's a real buzz, a lot of people there. It's a massive trade show. And, of course, they have the huge swine show there for kids from all across the U.S. And, you know, I guess there's a quite an enthusiastic feeling right now, but a couple of things, I guess, stood out for me, and one was that there was actually two press conferences on foot and mouth disease. So it seems like right now there's a big concern in the industry about this disease coming in to North America from places like India or other parts of the world.
Yeah, disease is always a big concern there, isn't it? And what else did you hear in the whole disease portfolio?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, PED, the porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, didn't come up too much, but really foot and mouth dominated. And there was, I guess, of course, you know, foot and mouth hasn't been in the U.S. for about, I guess, 9 decades or so, and it hasn't been in Canada since the 1950s. But it seems right now that there's just, you know, quite a significant worry that foot and mouth is going to arrive, and its impact could be really devastating. You know, some of the numbers thrown out, they suggested that if it did arrive, there was an outbreak in the U.S., the impact could be about $13 billion annually in cost to the livestock industry, which, of course, is quite significant. So, and the thinking is, interesting, that, you know, possibly that imported feed, things like soybean meal,
might be the source of this infection, which is quite interesting to me.
Yeah, I think they've talked about that with PED, that there might be a connection there.
Yeah, and so there's been some research in Minnesota showing that PED, the virus, could survive in a shipment of feed going from China all the way to Iowa for, like, I think up to, like, about 5 weeks. So definitely it's something that could happen with foot and mouth as well.
And at the World Pork Expo, trade is always a big issue, with the U.S. industry becoming more like Canada's, being very reliant on trade. What were people saying about things like TPP and the NAFTA renegotiation?
Well, the national pork producers in the U.S. are, of course, huge supporters of NAFTA because, you know, Canada and Mexico are critical markets for U.S. pork exports. I think Mexico is the number two market for U.S. pork, is over $1 billion, and I think Canada is the number four market for U.S. pork. I think it's something like $800 million last year in exports from the U.S. So they really want to maintain that access, and so their position is kind of they support updating NAFTA as long as there's no impact on the hog industry in the U.S. And, you know, interestingly, they don't like to use the word renegotiate. They prefer to use the term update NAFTA. And, you know, they realize that, you know, how critical this integrated market is for the hog industry. And so they, you know, are constantly lobbying in Washington to make sure that, you know, NAFTA, the rules around no duties, no quota, no tariffs are maintained. So, and in terms of TPP, you know, it's interesting that really the emphasis right now seems to be on the U.S. negotiating bilateral deals with countries like Japan, and they're approaching it that way rather than the TPP route, which was, of course, a collective of about 12 countries in the Pacific Rim having a free trade agreement. It seems like the pork producers are encouraging folks in Washington and the Trump administration to kind of pursue direct trade deals with Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam, those kind of countries. And so that seems to be the point of emphasis when it comes to trade right now.
And talking of trade, let's talk about something ugly. Country of origin labeling, at least from a Canadian perspective, that was a pretty nightmarish situation. There's a new administration and a new Congress in the U.S. Was there any talk at the World Pork Expo about COOL perhaps coming back onto the policy ledger?
Yeah, so there was quite a lengthy press conference about trade where the National Pork Producers representatives talked about trade issues, and really COOL didn't come up until I asked a question about it, and then it was discussed for maybe about 10 minutes. And I guess, you know, the hog farmers in the U.S., you know, majority of them, at least the industry leaders, are opposed to a reintroduction of COOL. But, you know, there are other forces in the U.S. that support bringing it back and would like it to be part of the NAFTA negotiations or NAFTA renegotiations. And so one of those groups is, of course, the National Farmers Union, and they're quite a powerful lobby in Washington. You know, they represent about 200,000 family farms across the U.S., and, you know, they're adamant that, you know, COOL should be introduced as part of the NAFTA update. So, you know, it's hard to say how this is going to play out. I mean, there's different forces and different groups that have varying opinions on this. So I wouldn't be surprised myself if it becomes part of the NAFTA talks and that it's used either as a bargaining chip for the U.S. to get something else, like out of Canada. Oh, but we'll see. It's hard to say how this is going to play out.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Robert.
Yeah, anyway, I was glad to be on Between the Rows this week, so thanks for the invite.
Robert Arneson is a reporter with the Western Producer. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Ed White of the Western Producer. Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather, joins us now to talk about the markets. Welcome to Between the Rows, Bruce.
It's good to be here.
So this summer, many of the crop markets have been a little dull, but that is not true about hard red spring wheat. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on there and why?
Well, there's a combination of factors here that is making the spring wheat market very interesting right at the present moment, and probably remain interesting through most of the marketing year here, because what we've seen is the combination of a drought. Part of it is in Western Canada, but most of it is in the U.S., and that's constraining the amount of production we're probably going to have this year in hard red spring wheat crop. As well, at the same time, we're having another poor protein harvest in the hard red winter wheat crop down in the U.S. The combination of both of those is making the protein wheat market very interesting at the present moment, and people are genuinely concerned about the supplies and how they're going to be able to last this year.
And durum grows in a lot of areas, either beside hard red spring wheat or bordering it. We don't have a futures contract to look at to see what's going on with the prices like we do with hard red spring wheat. So can you tell us a bit about how durum is being affected by this and what's going on with that?
Well, certainly the durum market hasn't been as buoyant as the spring wheat market, and has followed it essentially here as we've gone through this dry phase. Part of that's just because the supplies of durum, especially here in Canada, are still pretty heavy in terms of last year's crop. And although the U.S. crop area for durum is at the center of this drought, and production is probably going to be dramatically lower, the overall world fundamentals haven't allowed the durum market to take off to any extent based on this drought.
And right now we're fully into weather market mode, where every day we see a blizzard of reports of different crop conditions happening across the North American growing region. I'm wondering how you, as a veteran crop watcher, melt this down into a nutshell take on the Northern Plains and Canadian prairies, and what you would describe the situation as now.
Well, certainly the situation in the U.S., even though they did receive some rains, especially in North Dakota last week, it's still going to be rather difficult for that crop to get back to even close to average production potential. And that's because it's too far advanced. Areas in South Dakota are already headed out. In fact, some areas are probably starting to prematurely turn color here at the end of June. So certainly those crops can't recover very well. In Canada, we're in a bit different situation. Our crop's just been planted. We received some very good rains last week in most areas of the prairies. So the crop conditions in the prairies are looking pretty good, especially for wheat, I would say, because in that dry period when we planted the crop, the wheat seemed to come up, and the stands of wheat seemed to be the best of most of the crops in Western Canada here. So certainly we're in a different situation than the U.S. On both sides of the border, we've seen a lower spring wheat area in terms of the overall region planted to it compared with, let's say, 5 years ago. So there's far less margin of error as well in terms of what kind of yields and expectations we have for this crop.
And how much impact are we already seeing in the markets from these real-world crop condition situations?
Well, certainly the spring wheat market, the futures market, has rallied. When you look at the spread or the difference between hard red winter wheat and hard red spring, we're at some very lofty levels right now. The other thing, though, is that the physical cash market is starting to turn a bit as well. Bids at the Gulf for higher protein hard red winter wheat have skyrocketed over the past couple of weeks here. And in fact, if you want to buy a hard red winter 12% protein, you will pay pretty close to what a spring wheat protein for Canadian wheat off the West Coast is. So you can certainly see now with this happening that exporters are going to be starting to scramble to find protein, and that certainly should help support the futures market as we go through this year.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Burnett is Glacier Farm Media's Director of Markets and Weather. That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for joining us on Between the Rows. I'm Ed White.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Between the Rows. Our goal at Bayer is to continue to progress our lineup of high-performing seed and crop protection solutions so that we can meet specific grower needs like yours. Because when it comes to your farm, Bayer is with you from beginning to end. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.